Welcome to Between Two Ovaries, your go-to for all things women's health.
A lot of people just say like, oh, my vagina.
Yeah.
And yes. That's
not your vagina.
No.
Well, it is.
We're here to cut through the confusion, bust some myths, and give you the facts straight from the experts.
You cannot still believe the amount of people that come to a gynecology clinic saying that they don't look right down there and they need something doing about it.
We're keeping it real, bringing you honest conversations about topics that matter to you.
Everything goes back to the menstrual cycle.
Yes. It's a low-risk procedure, but it's not a no-risk procedure.
From periods to menopause and everything in between, we've got you covered.
So whether you're here to learn, laugh, or just listen, you are in the right place.
As soon as I said it.
Hi everyone, so welcome back to Between Two Ovaries. Today's episode is called Infertility Insights, What You Need to Know.
Yeah, so we've done an episode on how to get pregnant, and obviously that's quite straightforward for people that get pregnant, no problems in inverted commas, but there's a lot of people out there that don't get pregnant straight away. They're waiting to get pregnant, it's been going on for a long time, is it normal, what can they do about it, how can we optimise care? And I think it was really important to discuss that, so that's why we thought this episode would be a good one for people. And if you don't want to get pregnant, but you're just interested, because you might have a friend that's going through infertility, you might have a friend that's going through IVF, and I think it's good to have the information. It's really a bit shrouded, like a lot of people do it on their own as a couple.
Yeah.
They don't have a great deal of support around them. And I think it's nice if you could offer some support if it's not affecting you and it's affecting somebody else, just to know a few insights into things, then it would be quite good for people.
Yeah, and as well, like a lot of people don't necessarily talk about it because there's quite a lot of taboo and stigma associated with not being able to get pregnant and infertility, definitely in I'd say in all cultures, but in some more than others.
Yeah.
So if that's you and you're really worried, like, is there something wrong with me, this information will be useful.
Yeah.
And we're also going to kind of go through, so if you are unable to get pregnant, the different causes and management, like how what you can actually do through IVF and other treatments. And the other thing as well is there's loads of myths to do with fertility. There's lots of misconceptions about, you know, whose problem is it, male, female. And sadly, because of that as well, there's a lot of capitalism that, you know, people taking advantage of people's vulnerabilities, selling you things on Instagram that are supposed to fix your fertility when it's just not proven.
I tried this and got pregnant the week after.
I stopped eating salad and then I got pregnant. Or like... have this fertility tea, it'll cost you 60 quid for a box, but guaranteed to get pregnant.
And all it's this really stuff difficult to ignore that.
Oh, if no. When you want to do
everything to get to somewhere.
Yeah, and you're in the depths of every month, you're getting your period and you're like, all I want to be is pregnant. And you're not telling people around you because it is that weird situation whereby you kind of don't want to tell people that you want to get pregnant because then you've got the pressure of them asking you if you're pregnant. But you do want a bit of support because it's that monthly cycle of, right, okay, I've got my period now, that's really crap, let's move on. Then you have your first part of your cycle, then you're moving towards ovulation, then you're going to ovulate, right, we need to have intercourse, come on, we need to have sex, this is the way to get pregnant. And then you're then thinking, am I pregnant?
Fingers crossed.
Do I feel pregnant? Do I feel different? What do my boobs feel like? Am I pregnant? Yeah. And then kind of some people will be taking pregnancy tests before their period is due.
Yeah, guilty.
And then getting to their period and being like, am I late? Am I an hour late? Could I be late? Could I be pregnant? No, I'm not pregnant. My period's just come.
Yeah.
And it's
so
like it's a roller coaster that you're living kind of on your own. And yet potentially you're living it with your male partner if you're in a heterosexual couple, but it's not the same because they're not going through that, like they haven't got that cycle of hormones, they don't know what's going on in your body.
They're kind of a little bit of a bystander, like they're there to support you, but it's
right,
really
we've
your
had
body
sex now, do we need to do a pregnancy test tomorrow? No, because that's not how it works. it's not the system.
I think it's hard as well when you can see other people around you getting pregnant.
Oh yeah.
And yeah.
If you want to be pregnant, everybody you know is pregnant. Yeah. Everybody you know is getting pregnant with no effort whatsoever.
Oh, we weren't even trying.
Yeah.
Worst thing.
Every TV programme you watch is to do with a pregnancy. Yeah. Every
advert you watch
is a pregnancy.
Well, yeah, and that's the other thing. Like, our phones listen to us. So if you're talking about or Googling or looking online at fertility-related things, you are going to be bombarded with Instagram adverts, Facebook adverts, yeah, trying to sell you things. That,
this is our phones after this podcast.
Yeah,
but it's mental.
A lot of those things you will look at them and think, well, you know, it's only 20 quid and if it'll help me get pregnant, I'll do it. Yeah. But that's so unfair because
and when you're
there might not
so
be any evidence
them,
behind
yeah.
that. And, you know, it's basically feeding on people's desperation, which is just horrible.
Taking money and time.
Yeah, definitely. So, yes, lots of reasons to cover this episode.
Yeah.
And it's really, really common. So 1 in 7 couples. That's a lot. Yeah. Everybody knows 7 couples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So 1 in 7 of those will be affected by fertility issues. So that is a lot of people. So if it doesn't affect you and you are, you got pregnant when you wanted to get pregnant, which is amazing. You got that positive pregnancy test and they ended up in a baby 9 months later. Again,
that's
amazing.
The goal.
That's the goal. That would be fantastic if that's what happened to people. We've already done an episode on miscarriage. We've discussed about ectopic pregnancy. There's so many in the minefield of pregnancy, but just that getting pregnant can be so difficult for people. Mm, and I think talking about it a little bit better and having the information there so that you can talk to other people about it just makes it less taboo and that you're more informed and you're not buying rubbish from the internet.
Yeah, definitely. And so it does affect 1 in 7 couples, but actually the kind of how common it is kind of increasing a little bit because of lots of different factors. But one of the main ones being that a lot of people are delaying getting pregnant until they're at a time that, A, they can afford it, that they're ready in terms of their lifestyle, their career and that kind of thing. So that also feeds into having lower fertility rates.
Yeah.
So it's not something that's going away and it's something that we
it's
all
only
going to
get more and more.
Yeah.
It's definitely only going to get more and more. With rising rates of obesity, with rising rates of unhealthy lifestyles in a lot of times, with rising rates of age. Age is a massive one. Female age, we cannot get away from. Female age with fertility just declines, and we've discussed this in our fertility episode. But it's not anything that we can get away from, basically.
No. Yeah.
So we need to discuss it so that people can kind of work out where they are and what they need to do about it if it is an issue.
So
we know that if you want to get pregnant, so if you want to get pregnant and you're having regular unprotected intercourse, and then 85% of people, heterosexual couples, will get pregnant within that first year. If you try for a second year, so you've 2 years of regular unprotected intercourse, then 90% of people will get pregnant. So there is actually only some more percentage after the 2 years, but they're the people that are going to struggle to get pregnant. And actually, the pregnancy rates don't go up very much after like 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah.
You need to see somebody and we need to have a think about it.
Yeah.
I think
that's
the long and the short of it.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
So, like, infertility would be kind of defined as if you've been having regular unprotected sex for 12 months and you've not got pregnant. That's what, you know, if you Google it, that's what will come up as the definition. But actually, a lot of the time, people might get pregnant again in that second year. But very relevant for this episode is you wouldn't actually qualify for free NHS IVF if you needed it until that 2 year mark has passed.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, your GP might refer you at 12 months depending on your age, circumstances.
Really depends on your age
because
if you're kind of 38, 39, if you think about the delays to get seen as well, like you need to be get seen quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're 25, it's a really
little bit more time.
They'll probably wait till
It's a really different story.
Yeah.
So there's going to be there's going to be differences in when people will get referred, and that's fine. With regards also to getting pregnant, although we said a year of regular unprotected intercourse, this is people that are having sex 2 to 3 times a week, because if somebody is thinking that they're having sex at the time that they can get pregnant every month and they've got it just totally wrong, they don't know how to get pregnant, they don't know when they can get pregnant, then actually their chances of getting pregnant are going to be tiny. So have a listen to the episode on how to get pregnant, and then if you are still struggling
timing, yeah. you're having sex at the right time, then we need to think about what we're going to do next.
And I think that that is more common than you think it is.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not anything, so it's quite normal to not actually know when your fertile window is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For many reasons. Firstly, we're not really taught that well in schools, nope. generally speaking. Some teachers are amazing, but not all schools are great. And then secondly, as a woman, as a girl, as an adolescent, you're taught that if you have sex or go near a man,
you
will get pregnant.
And an STI,
so
probably.
You think
yeah.
that it's
so you think you're fertile
yeah.
all the time, and you're not. You're actually only fertile yeah. in the days yeah. leading up to and of ovulation.
I think it's hard as well if you've been on hormonal contraception, then you're coming off and you're not sure mm-hmm. where your cycle is.
Are you back to normal yet? Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
I, so think I think it is common. What you've said is so right. Like, you're going to come off on the pill on the Friday. Well, I need to be careful because I don't want to get pregnant Saturday, Sunday, so I better keep on till the Sunday and
yeah.
then we'll come on.
Yeah.
And some people do get pregnant that quickly, but most don't.
Yeah, most don't, but
I think
it is
you need
possible.
To be a bit more realistic yeah. about things.
Got to be prepared for both eventualities.
Yeah. yeah.
So who does it affect?
Yeah, so, well, most important thing to know is that it does affect men and women mm-hmm. equally. Mm-hmm. So I think generally people think, okay, infertility, it must be the woman's problem.
Yeah.
Not true. So it's equal factors from the male and female side.
Yep.
So about a third a male factor, about a third a female factor, and then about a third a kind of unexplained, unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll go into a little bit more about what those different things could be between mm-hmm. men and women.
And just a slight tangent, but we talk about primary and secondary infertility, and I think this
yeah.
is a word that's kind of bandied about a bit, and people would be kind of like, what's the difference?
Yeah. Yeah.
So primary means that you've never been pregnant ever, ever, ever.
Okay.
Secondary infertility can mean that you've had a child already, but it also could mean that you've had a miscarriage, you've had an ectopic pregnancy, so you have been pregnant,
yeah.
whether you've had a child
yeah.
or not, and that can be secondary infertility.
Okay. That makes sense.
Are they treated differently?
So, it depends about funding rather
yeah.
than anything else, really. But it's just, I think, when people use words that people aren't afraid with, then it's better to kind of explain what they are.
Yeah,
yeah.
definitely.
We will come into the funding later on as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, so unexplained is obviously unexplained. So we don't know why you're not getting pregnant, you and your partner. So you essentially have normal test results.
Mm-hmm.
You've been trying for up to 2 years
yeah.
And you're not getting pregnant, but there's no known cause for
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
So that might be because we don't know all the causes of infertility yet,
mm-hmm. yeah.
But it basically means that with the tools we have and the tests we have, we can't find a reason.
Yeah. yeah. Female factors. So obviously we said male and female have both got, or both can have issues, or there can be a mixture of both of them. But female, we obviously need to think about female's age,
mm-hmm.
and then we also need to think about different conditions. So you can have polycystic ovarian syndrome, so you're not ovulating consistently.
Mm-hmm.
So that can be a case of if you're having 2 periods a year or no periods whatsoever, mm-hmm. you're not going to get pregnant.
No,
because you're not ovulating, you haven't got a chance
yeah.
to get pregnant. So PCOS can be a reason why you're not getting pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
You can have premature ovarian insufficiency, so you're not having periods because actually you've gone through the menopause, and this does happen to people
yeah.
when they're 20,
yeah.
when they're 30. So these people obviously are not going to be able to get pregnant. Well, some people do sporadically ovulate
mm-hmm.
and will get pregnant. So if you don't want to get pregnant, you should be on contraception. But on the whole, if you have premature ovarian insufficiency, we would help you with regards to getting pregnant, because it might be that you couldn't use your own eggs to get pregnant.
Mm.
Some people can have chromosomal problems. So some women have a condition called Turner's.
Well, I've heard of that.
Mm. So Turner syndrome means that, so female would have XX.
Chromosomes.
Male would
mm-hmm.
have XY
mm-hmm.
chromosomes on the whole,
mm-hmm.
But some females will have X0, so they're
mm-hmm.
missing an X chromosome, or they can
okay.
have some of the chromosome missing. So you can have mosaic Turners, so not full Turners,
mm-hmm.
or full Turners. And people with Turners usually undergo premature ovarian insufficiency. Sometimes people are mosaic Turners, so not full Turners, would still get pregnant. But it might be more difficult, so
yeah.
that's another genetic condition.
And you might not know that you have that chromosomal
no.
yeah.
abnormalities. You might only find that out when you get to a certain age that you want to try and get pregnant.
Yeah.
So it can be a complete shock.
Yeah.
yeah.
That sounds rough.
Mm.
Yeah, definitely. People don't know that they've gone through premature ovarian insufficiency sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So we see a myriad of things in the fertility clinic that
yes, obviously, I know we do have unexplained, but we can have some that can be pinpoint explained to something.
Yeah.
And we're having to give really bad news to people that they are unaware is coming.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff to think about.
Well, obviously, to get pregnant from the female side, you need to ovulate. So they're the things that, they're some of the things that can affect your ovulation. But there can also be things like if you are, have a very low BMI, if you're someone that works out a lot, you're like an athlete, you might actually not be sending signals to your ovaries to release an egg, which is a bit of a protective mechanism from your body.
Stress mode.
Yeah, it's like your body's basically
fight
saying,
off, like, should we have
this
a baby
is not a
right
good
now?
Time to get pregnant. that would be bad for us. So it tells your ovaries to stop producing eggs. So that can be as a result of excessive exercise. It could just be you have a low BMI. It could also be induced by stress. Mm-hmm. So if someone's going through a really stressful period of illness or stress caused by other things, your body can shut down those hormone signals and you will then not ovulate as well.
If you have thyroid conditions, you can stop ovulating as well. So there is a lot of conditions that can be linked to it. Sometimes if you have, you'll come and you'll tell us that you're not having periods, you'll have your prolactin checked and you might have a little prolactin producing tumour in your pituitary, and that can cause prolactin, which would stop you again from ovulating. So there's loads of different things.
And they're
that
really
can cause
treatable as well.
Yeah, so like really straightforward treatable. Yeah.
It's not a cancer, it's like so the pituitary is a little like gland that sits inside your brain, just dangles down behind your eyes.
Just here.
Produces lots of hormones.
Well, they operate it through your nose.
If you need to do removing, you can get a little like overgrowth on there and that can produce hormones. And one of those could be prolactin. Prolactin is what's released when you're breastfeeding.
Yeah.
So that suppresses ovulation during breastfeeding. So it can do the same thing without the breastfeeding if you've got an overgrowth.
Yeah.
And they're really easily treatable. You can give medication and sometimes you might need surgery.
Yeah.
Obviously.
So that is another condition. Sometimes you would stop ovulating because you've had treatments that have stopped you ovulating. So you might have had a cancer that's had a chemotherapy and then you're not going to ovulate because we've knocked off your ovulation because of that. You've had like an extreme illness, basically.
Yeah.
So there's loads of medications that can stop you from ovulating as well. If you're on antipsychotic medication. So we need to take a full history, see where you're up to, see what's going on to kind of work out what could be causing an ovulation. Another one actually is people, if they're on non-steroidals, so kind of long-term non-steroidals. So
painkillers, like
painkillers,
like anti-inflammatory.
Yeah, anti-inflammatory medication. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there is quite a lot of stuff that can cause you to not ovulate.
Wow.
So have a think about what you're on. The other things as well that can cause problems with fertility are medications that you don't usually think about. So your marijuana, so if you're smoking weed, if you're taking cocaine, so that kind of stuff we do ask about. I'm not sure how truthful people are with that kind of stuff.
Probably not.
But we do need to know about it so we can work out what's going on.
Yeah. At least then, if you're not going to admit it, you'll be prompted to maybe stop doing it.
Maybe
so
that might have been an
for
issue.
While you're trying to get pregnant. Yeah. So yeah, you need to ovulate. So there are things that can affect your ovary. You also need the egg to be able to get from your ovary to your uterus to your womb, so the fallopian tube. Mm-hmm. So there are conditions that mean that your fallopian tube don't function normally. Mm-hmm. So those are things like if you've had a previous pelvic inflammatory disease, so pelvic infection or current, which can be caused by STIs like chlamydia, gonorrhea, but can also be caused by other things. Mm-hmm. Not everyone will get this, but a small number of people might get scarring or damage to the tube after having that infection.
Mm-hmm. And is that if it's left untreated or just...
Yes, if you have treatment, very, very unlikely to happen. Okay. It's more in those cases where you've not known you've had an infection and it's gone untreated
for a while.
Time.
Yeah.
Even then, it might not happen to you, but that's more likely.
Yeah.
And that's because then if the egg gets into the tube, it might not be able to make its way down because the tube is blocked, or it might get lost somewhere, and so that can cause reduced fertility.
Yeah, you can also have endometriosis, which is distorting the anatomy, so making the tubes not be able to join into the womb, or you could have endometriosis on the fallopian tubes, or you could just have an inflammatory environment that's stopping you from getting pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So with endometriosis, a lot of times we're not completely aware of why you're not getting pregnant, and most people with early onset endometriosis, or not early onset because we don't know the progression, but if you have stage one, two endometriosis, chances are you will get pregnant. 7 in 10 people will get pregnant with no problem whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But it can lead to this kind of inflammatory environment. Mm-hmm. If you have stage 3-4 endometriosis, it can cause real distortion of the anatomy. Mm-hmm. So it's not kind of in the inverted commas normal places. Your tubes aren't free. Your fimbria aren't wafting that egg down the tube.
Get it in every episode. We're waft.
So there's lots of different things from an endometriosis point of view that can cause issues.
And then your uterus itself can have problems that can prevent pregnancy. So one of those things might be if the lining of your womb is affected somehow. So some people can get scar tissue in the lining of the womb, which is called Asherman syndrome. That can be from lots of procedures in the past. It could be from infection. It doesn't happen to everyone, and then the people that it happens to don't always have problems getting pregnant, but that can be one thing. And then same with things like fibroids, which we've done an entire episode on. But if you have a fibroid that is in the kind of lining of the womb or changing the shape of the lining of your womb, then that can prevent pregnancies implanting there as well. And polyps can, it's unclear, isn't it?
We're not really sure. And if you're having fertility treatment, we would take off a polyp because we'd want the cavity to be as clear, good a location as possible. But we're not entirely sure that how they affect a pregnancy, really, because you should still have lots of endometrium in which for a pregnancy to implant. The other thing, I suppose, is from a uterine, so from a womb situation, you might not have a womb, but you might not know this until you start having investigations for why you're not getting pregnant. If you've got ovaries and you've just not had periods, you've got a vagina, you're managing to have intercourse, it might be that you've got a developmental issue with regards to the womb itself. And there can be lots of different variants of this. So you might have a womb that's quite small, you might have no womb, you might have two wombs. You might have one womb that's got a little womb attached to it. So you can have all these different variants.
And you wouldn't know about it.
That's crazy.
You might not know about
it. You might not know. Have any idea.
I mean, a lot of people would turn up earlier because they've not started the periods. Or they would turn up because actually they've started the periods and they're really painful because they've got a block torn or that kind of thing. But you still do have people that will come and be like, I've not seen anyone about the fact I've not started my periods, but I'm also now want to get pregnant and I'm not able to get pregnant. So there are different conditions that you would see.
And they're like very, so absence of uterus is very rare. It does exist, but it's called MRKH. It's like Mayer-Rokitansky-Hauser syndrome.
Wow, what a name.
Yeah, long name, but very, very rare. And usually they're the people that when they get to kind of age of when you would expect your period to happen and you've not got one, that's when you'd be prompted to go to the doctor. So most people do know about it earlier on, but it's, much more common to have changes in the way that your womb's developed, which is what you were describing
like
before.
The configuration.
As well.
So, yeah, there can be lots of different things going on with regards to that.
And then
male
factor.
So, male. Or you do a semen analysis, but realistically, there are people that wouldn't be able to ejaculate, so wouldn't be able to form, wouldn't be able to do a semen analysis. So, some people cannot ejaculate inside their partner, or they could ejaculate outside on their own or with their partner, but not inside.
So men need to be able to have an erection, to ejaculate, and to have sperm in the ejaculate to get pregnant. But anything can go wrong. People may not be able to maintain an erection for medical reasons or medication or psychological reasons. May not be able to ejaculate for the same things. And then also, if they do, they may not have no sperm or may have low sperm, which is much more common than no sperm.
And we don't expect much, to be honest. So in the semen analysis, we actually have really low expectations because men form, on the whole, millions and millions of sperm in each ejaculate. You actually only need a very small proportion of them to be, in inverted commas, normal.
Good swimmers.
Well, you only need one, don't you?
Well, probably need more than that. But but you don't expect too much of them in a semen analysis. But it might be that they're not producing any sperm, as we said, but there might be just a physical barrier. So they've got an absence of the tube that's going from the testicles into the ejaculate. Or it might be that, they've got blockage. And they could have a cyst there. And they could have had
treatment that means that they would be infertile. So if they've had the testicle removed, mm-hmm. if the testicles have never come down into the scrotum, if they have had chemotherapy. So there could be lots of situations where actually they're not going to produce sperm for a very specific reason. And when you go back through the history, you're like, oh, that makes sense. But it's something to make sure that we're kind of looking into all of these things.
Yeah. And you can also have chromosomal
abnormalities.
We're just so in sync. So yeah, you can, as well as you can with women, you can also have male chromosomal abnormalities that you might not be aware of until you get to this point when you're trying to get pregnant, and they can cause low sperm count or no sperm. And then also really common, do you want to mention
so that's just like an extra, so we'll be only because we've been internists, so I feel like we have to go into this. So male chromosome usually XY, but what they would do is have an extra X. So XXY. And that could decrease their fertility, basically.
And a really common, really, really common cause of male factor infertility is the use of steroids. So steroids in the gym, obviously everyone wants to be big and butch and wants to use steroids sometimes in the gym. Maybe someone offers them to you at your young age. It does affect your fertility. Testicles get smaller and it affects your sperm count. So a lot of people don't know that as well, because these are not prescribed drugs. It might be something that someone has just like given you in the gym, or you've heard about at a young age and then you've not thought about or not been aware of the potential impact on your fertility. But and that is quite a common thing that
the other thing is that a lot of people will go and see practitioners now with hypogonadism, so they'll have a testosterone that's like a little bit decreased, so then they'll be given testosterone, and if you're given testosterone as like a medication, then you stop producing as much testosterone. So that affects your sperm count as well. So you know, in America it's like a massive thing whereby there was a really good article on it recently, that there were these people like peddling testosterone, and they were going to fire stations full of like men that obviously need to be on their top form a lot of the time, and they're kind of saying, oh, are you tired, have you got like, how are you feeling these days, can you not do as much as you used to do, go on testosterone because it will make you amazing. And then they go on testosterone and they then can't get pregnant because they've got sperm. There's like an epidemic of it in America, people going on all of the testosterone.
There are actually like a lot of male supplements will have a bit of testosterone in them as well, so I think be aware of what you're taking if you're trying to get pregnant.
With optimizing health before you want him to get pregnant.
So there's in lots of different supplements, so in meal replacement
shakes
and stuff, you need to be just careful what is in everything. It's better just to have a healthy diet rather than try to be doing like meal replacements, but I also do understand that people would want to lose weight efficiently, so it might be more of a short-term thing that people do. There's also medications that can affect, so if someone's got kind of a Crohn's, they might be on medication, so like a bowel
like inflammatory
problem,
bowel disease,
they might be on medications that affects the sperm count. Some of the medications to prevent like swelling can affect sperm counts. So there's lots of different things. Also other drugs, so like your weed, your cocaine, all those affect
all the bad
sperm
ones.
Count.
All the big bad ones,
So it's... when we're thinking about causes, there's loads of causes. And it's definitely, you can see why there's so much overlap between male and female. And you can see sometimes why there's so much unexplained, because once we've done like the tests, like that's the end point. And it could be something else underlying.
Age as well for men, we should mention, because although age is younger, so women get to an age where they're then, their fertility is affected much earlier, around 35, but that's not to say that if you're 35 you won't get pregnant. It just generally starts to decline after that, but for men it is a little bit later, but it still happens. It is still a factor. If you're 70 and you're trying to get pregnant and you're not, it could be that you're 70.
I think it's that whole thing where I think a lot of it is still put on the female, and it's the same like even in clinic, because we're just like, oh, what's your height and weight, your BMI's got to be less than 30, but like we're not stringent on the males at all.
Really? Does the BMI only apply to the woman?
Yeah.
That's men.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, because that must affect their fertility.
Yeah, especially if you then, you know, did all your tests, found out it was the man.
Well, they would still have a semen analysis, I suppose, actually.
Oh, yeah.
But still,
it's still like...
It's still important to be
optimize both
good version of yourself when you're becoming a parent.
So when you're not being able to get pregnant and you're having a bit more of a think about it, I think lifestyle is the first thing to think about. Are you smoking? This really decreases your chance of getting pregnant. How fit and healthy are you? Do you think you could do with losing a bit of weight? Are you eating the best foods that you could eat? Your chances of getting pregnant are less if your BMI is higher, and also your chances of miscarriage are higher. So it's something to really think about, because you would be better optimizing pre-getting pregnant, really, for a healthy pregnancy as well, because there's a lot of things that are affected when you're pregnant if you're carrying more weight. So it would be better to kind of be optimized if you can be. The other thing is pre-pregnancy vitamin. So have a think, if you want to get pregnant, you need to get that folic acid in as soon as possible. So taking kind of a preconceived vitamin just off the shelf, you know, would be great. It would contain everything that you need to be taking. So
folic acid, think about optimizing. Super, super important as well, because you want to take it for at least 3 months before you try and get pregnant. But you know, if you're trying to get pregnant, just start it whenever you remember to. But the reason it's really important is because it prevents neural tube defects. So basically, when the baby, when you are pregnant, the baby kind of forms initially, like the back forms kind of folding up together, and then it kind of stitches up. And sometimes there can be a problem with that process if your folate is low, if your folic acid is low. So it can cause things like spina bifida, you might have heard of. So by making sure you've got folic acid on board when you're trying to get pregnant, you're reducing that risk of it happening when you do get pregnant, and you continue it as well when you get pregnant.
Take your pre-pregnancy vitamin.
And same for men as well. So there's like prenatal vitamins for men that can help to optimize their health. They should stop smoking. They should reduce alcohol, regular exercise. Do it together.
The men really need to be focused on from that side as well. And there are some men that are doing the wrong things by kind of like boiling their testicles, in a sense, by kind of being on bikes all the time.
And cycling,
sitting in hot tubs for hours on. Hot laptop on your tummy. So there are definitely things that from both sides, and you both need to optimize your lifestyle factors. It's not just a female issue.
Definitely.
With regards to the folic acid, just a slight deviation. I went to a conference recently, and there was a debate, or there was supposed to be a debate, on what supplements people should take. And I was like, oh, this would be great. I can use this in clinic. It's going to be really informative. And basically, after the whole of this debate, that wasn't really a debate in the end, they just said that people should be on folic acid. It's the only thing that's proven to help. Like, realistically, when you drill everything down, folic acid.
That basically just highlights that there's not a lot of good evidence around supplements and fertility. So the one thing we know is good is folic acid. They were kind of like, vitamin D's great, but the evidence is still not as strong as with folic acid. And all these other new supplements, basically, we don't know if they're actually going to improve your fertility. But I think you can be sensible about these things and think, is there a rationale behind it? Is it likely to be, and talk to your, if you go into a fertility clinic, talk to the doctor that you see there, because they'll
and
be able to advise.
And if something's not detrimental, then it's probably okay to take, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I feel bad, as we said on the how to get pregnant one, we missed out folic acid, which
we did.
We got berated about.
Well, we'll put it in there.
So it's important. Folic acid is important for pregnancy. Trying to get pregnant.
So you've not been able to get pregnant. You've optimized your lifestyle. You're a couple of years down the line, or you're a bit older and you're a year down the line. You need to be seeing your GP and getting that referral so that we can get these tests done and hopefully reassure you. But if not, get on with any treatment that you may or may not need. So see your GP, get referred, and then get the test done. So, if you come to clinic, what tests would you be having? And as an aside, if you're going to come to clinic and you're in a couple, I'm not saying that everybody's in a couple, you need to come as a couple because we need to know about both of you. So you can't just turn up and be like, oh, my partner's at work. You need to both be there because we need to know that you're both committed for this. And some of the questions that we ask are very much kind of, because these are the tests that, these are the questions that are dictated. How long have you been together? How long have you lived together? How long have you been trying to get pregnant? So you can't just turn up on your own.
Yeah, fair.
if you have a partner. I know some people will be coming to fertility clinic without a partner because they're thinking of embarking a fertility journey on their own. And these people can obviously be supported, not at the moment in an NHS setting on the whole, but we can do all the investigations in an NHS setting to get you set up.
It's just the funding, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the funding.
You can still go to an NHS hospital. It's just that you would then have to pay for the treatments.
Actual treatments.
Well, we are actually going to do an episode on, because fertility is so wide spanning, you're not just a male, female, heterosexual couple trying to get pregnant. There are other kinds of couples. So we're going to do a separate episode on that. So we'll cover like single people, we'll cover egg freezing, and we'll cover same-sex couples, things like surrogacy. We'll cover all of that because that is really interesting. And I think a lot of people want to hear about that as
Definitely.
Well. But this is your barn door.
Yes.
Male, female, heterosexual couple.
Yes. So you would come and the female would have one set of investigations. So you would have chlamydia and gonorrhea. So we want to check that you've not got any dormant kind of infection, especially some of the tests that we do further down the line would dictate that you're not allowed to have chlamydia and gonorrhea at the time because we don't want to be flushing it into your abdomen. Mm-mm. So we always check chlamydia and gonorrhea. We check that you are rubella immune. So most people will have had MMR jabs.
Yeah, back in school.
In school. You'll be rubella immune because we don't want people to get pregnant that aren't rubella immune. Rubella in pregnancy is really not a good idea. So at that point, it's, for the baby, not for you. So at that point, it's a good option for us, again, to optimise health. Mm-hmm. So you're not rubella immune. Go see your GP, get a little rubella shot. Let's have a think about what we can do so that you are optimised.
Because when you know, if you do go through IVF and you get pregnant, you want that pregnancy to have the best chances. Yes. You don't want to then be at risk.
Yeah. It's like when we discussed polyps earlier, we're not really sure about polyps, so but also let's just do everything. Yeah. It's like belt and braces kind of.
Yeah. They're easy and safe to remove, so then it makes sense to try and optimise it.
You will also have something called an AMH, which we have discussed in our How to Get Pregnant episode. Yes. But this is the right time to have an AMH because you are in a fertility actual clinic.
Yeah.
And so your AMH is your fertility potential. It's your anti-malarian hormone. Mm-hmm. Your anti-malarian hormone, your fertility potential, does not correlate to get pregnant naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So even if your AMH is low, if you're having regular periods, then your AMH does not affect how you will get pregnant naturally.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Your AMH is really, really very useful if you're going to have IVF.
Okay.
Because it will guide us about what dose of medication you need to be on. So if you have a low AMH, you need to be on a higher dose of stimulation medication.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go into that in a second. And if you've got a really high AMH, it can do a couple of things. It can point to the fact that you might have polycystic ovarian syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'd said that in our PCOS episode, that AMH can correlate quite nicely with PCOS because you've got so many follicles, your AMH is really high. And it alerts us to the fact that you might be somebody that is going to produce too many eggs. So we need to put you on a really low dose and we need to monitor you really carefully because we don't want you to get something called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome.
Which we'll explain a bit more later. So don't worry if you don't know what that is just yet.
AMH is really important, but I think too much weight is put on it in the aspects of life that it probably shouldn't be done in.
This is the only time that you should have an AMH,
which
is a blood
test. You see a lot of
online
kits of test your fertility with this, and that's not.
It's not testing your fertility because there are really, really good studies done saying that it doesn't correlate to getting pregnant naturally.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, if your AMH is 0 or 0.2, then you're probably not going to get pregnant naturally. But your periods have probably been affected, so you're probably not having regular periods.
And it induces so much stress. If you are someone that's these adverts will tell you, thinking about getting pregnant in the next 12 months, you should have this blood test from this private clinic. We'll send it you in the post. It'll be £120, please.
Yeah.
You'll do that, and then you'll get a result that doesn't make sense to you because no one's there to explain it.
Yep.
But it actually doesn't mean that you will... You have an AMH of 12. What does that mean? Who knows? Because no one has studied it in the context of people outside of IVF clinics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It might just make you feel really stressed, really worried, thinking you have to find a partner and get pregnant tomorrow.
Although you need no evidence for it. And the problem is, if you've got a low AMH, then you're not a good candidate for an egg freeze.
Okay.
So, because if your AMH is low, it means that you've not got loads of follicles. So we want you to produce lots of follicles as part of IVF. So,
but you could still get pregnant naturally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we only need you to
really should be used in a fertility clinic.
AMH something that changes?
Not really. It can change. It shouldn't do, basically. But it can change if you're on the pill.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So it can be artificially lower if you're on the pill.
Gotcha. Which they won't tell you when you're buying it online.
And can just send you into panic.
Yeah.
So, it's not a good idea to do it outside of a fertility clinic.
Yeah. Yeah. Or unless, I mean, some people are going to have egg freezing because they feel it's the right time of their life and this is the right... And that's totally fine. Have your AMH because you'll need that as part of your fertility journey, treatment, etc. But if you're not thinking of getting pregnant, or if you're thinking of getting pregnant in a couple of years' time, that it's not going to change anything. Mm-hmm. On a monthly basis, we need you to ovulate one egg.
Yeah.
When we're doing fertility treatment, we want these follicles, lots of follicles, so we can collect lots of eggs and play the numbers game of what's going to develop.
Yeah.
So I think outside a fertility setting, people shouldn't be really checking their AMH. Yeah. I don't think it adds a lot apart from anxiety.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Get that.
So that's your AMH. You'll also get a scan. Mm-hmm. And this is to make sure, as we discussed previously, some people can have like anatomical, so their anatomy can be slightly distorted or slightly different to the textbook norm. And then that would kind of make us think, do we need to do any treatments? Mm-hmm. Is there a fibroid in the cavity? Is there a polyp in the cavity? Is there water in your tubes? So can we see that your fallopian tubes are like
swollen.
Mm-hmm.
And which might indicate a previous infection.
Yeah.
Yeah, if they're swollen, we might need to do something about it. We'll have a discussion about that in a second.
And the scan will be a vaginal scan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you won't be having a scan over your tummy. It'll be a vaginal ultrasound scan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It won't be painful. It's just a little bit uncomfortable. Because you're having a vaginal scan,
basically. And what we'll do is count the follicles as well in your ovaries, so we can see these little follicles that are in your ovaries, and that also helps us with regards to, does that correlate with your AMH?
Yeah.
What is your fertility potential? What dose of medication do you need to put in? So there's a few things that that helps with when we're doing that scan. It adds up to everything together. And then from a male side, they will have a semen analysis. Mm. And as I said, we actually don't expect that much. So we want, on the WHO, so the World Health Organization, they tell us kind of what we are expecting from a semen analysis. And the levels have decreased through the years, like of what we're expecting.
Oh, right. So,
Yeah, so there's been lots of versions of the World Health Organization semen analysis. And, I mean, genuinely, we want 4% normal sperms. So out of
4%.
These millions, we just want 4% normal. And we would like 30% of them to be moving. Mm-hmm. And then we do want like 15 million per mil, but
high expectation in that, but low expectation of them all.
Low expectation of the ones that we see.
To give a semen sample, you would have to, generally speaking, it's best to come into the fertility clinic, go into a little room, produce your sample in a pot, and then hand it in straight away.
Yeah.
But if you
not in the toilet, not in the corridor, not
there's
in the room,
there's
you
a place
in the natural room.
In the corridor.
But then also, if that's something that you really, really can't do, my understanding is that you can do it at home and bring it in.
But it needs to be in within an hour. So
keep it, but your body temperature is another
thing. It just needs to be in a timely manner. Yeah. So these are booked in. You have an appointment for this. You don't just turn up like you do with a urine in the hospital.
Don't
like,
fly. No,
definitely not.
It needs to be fresh. So you would have that semen analysis done and analysed, and then we would see you with the results of all of these things. So you would have a follow-up whereby we go through the results of all the things that we've done from a female side, all the things that we've done from a male side. So you would come to see a medic and you would get all the results from all your investigations back, and we can discuss about potential treatments. But for treatments on the NHS, if you need IVF, if you need ovulation induction, if you need any treatments from a fertility side, then you will need to meet the funding criteria for the NHS. So you need to have had a couple of years of unprotected intercourse and not got pregnant, or if you're in a same-sex couple, you need to have had 6 IUIs, so intrauterine insemination, so you've paid for sperm to be put in the right place at the right time.
Basically, that's like if you're a same, if you're two females, you each time you ovulate, you can do something called intrauterine insemination, so sperm donor, then that the sperm gets injected into your uterus, and then if you have had that 6 times essentially and not got pregnant, that the NHS counts as the same as having infertility. So you do have to pay for that, but if then you've done that 6 times and not got pregnant, you can then qualify for NHS IVF.
Okay.
So you also need to be a UK resident, you need to be with a GP in the UK. You can be up to the age of 40. The NHS says that you would be funded for 3 cycles of IVF, but actually that's not the case at all. Most are funded for 1 or 2 cycles, and in different regions, actually, it's only up to the age of 35 that are covered.
Oh, wow.
So it really is a postcode lottery with regards to age and funding. Here, between the age of 40 and 42, you are funded for 1 cycle of IVF. You never get more than that if you're over 40. And if you age changes within that time span, then that, like, that's it. So if you were funded for 2 cycles when you were 39, you have your first cycle, then you go 40, then you wouldn't have another cycle. So it's very much kind of
That's rough.
I know.
It can be.
It's really difficult, and especially when people wait on waiting lists and there's been delays and that kind of thing. But you can put in individual funding requests, and mostly they get rejected for these kind of things. It's and on the letters that people get with regards to funding, everything's in capitals about, like, if you turn 40, you will only ever be funded for 1 cycle. Before the age of 40, you can get 2 cycles or 1 cycle, or whatever they were funded for. And then it also says that if you become pregnant and have a child, then you won't get any further funding at all. So everything is, like, very written in bold.
Sounds very scary.
There's a lot of stuff there that people have got to be aware of. And the other thing is that your AMH has got to be a certain level. So your fertility potential, that that blood test that we were talking about, has got to be a certain level. And that's because on the whole, we know that people with an AMH that's lower than that just really won't do very well at all with regards to IVF. They might be able to, you know, they might still get pregnant naturally. The issue is that these people have been people that have been trying to get pregnant for a couple of years before. So as we've said, the chances of then getting pregnant naturally are still quite low. But if your AMH is low, you won't qualify for treatment because IVF is probably just not going to be that helpful for you. The other is BMI. So you have got to have a BMI between 19 and 29.9. So your BMI's got to be less than 30, but it's also got to be 19 or above. So that is really difficult for a lot of people. A lot of people coming through with PCOS will really struggle to lose weight, and we've discussed that before about the insulin resistance and the difficulties for that. But it's kind of a it's a very much black and white. Like, if your BMI is over 30, you don't qualify for treatment. And that is it. And it's not my doing. It's not it's the clinic's not your choice, doing. That is the rules.
And is there criteria for men as well?
The men can't be smoking, and the woman also can't be a smoker. But we don't ask for their BMI. Which probably seems a bit unfair because it clearly does affect. And then neither of them can have children from any previous relationship.
Or adopted.
At all?
No.
But this, this is NHS England.
So in Wales, it's different. So in Wales...
not even adopted children.
No. So in Wales, it is different. So
you can have a child from a previous relationship in
Wales. Of you can have a child from a previous relationship in Wales. It's usually how it works. And Wales, usually you get funded for 3 rounds as well. So if you live on that border, have your GP in Wales.
Jump.
Yeah, definitely.
So maybe do your research as to where you want to be.
Well, if you had to choose and you could have a GP in Wales or England, then get your GP in Wales. Because it's not the GP that is funding your IVF, but it's where the GP is kind of where it sits, where it's based, will be where your funding will come from. And if your funding comes from Wales, then you always have better funding.
If the cost of moving house is less than the cost of IVF, probably move house if you're someone that has a partner with a child.
I suppose the issue is as well that you have to think about the coverage. So we have people that will be coming from like Bangor and like miles and miles away for treatment because there isn't like those the treatment clinics there. So there's a lot of things to think about with regards to that, but funding is a funny one. And in some ways it makes it really easy because you can be like, you don't meet the criteria, I'm really sorry. You can come back when you've lost weight. You can, you don't meet the criteria because of your image. It makes it quite simple. But on the other hand, it's really difficult to tell people that they don't need funding. And some people are very resilient and they knew it before they got to the appointment. Some people really have got no idea that they're going to not meet funding criteria. And it can be a really difficult conversation. And there can be a lot of, well, my friend had it and her BMI was 35. And this is, and it's like that. That's not on the NHS.
That's the thing to be really clear about as well. This is for free IVF on the NHS. It doesn't mean that you can't have IVF if you self-fund. So there are lots of private clinics that might even be within NHS hospitals that you can then, if you have the money, you can pay for IVF. It doesn't mean you cannot have it at all. But no, it's not. And this is the most accessible way to get IVF, obviously.
It's definitely not accessible for everybody. And also, if you have a BMI of 32 and decide that you definitely can't lose weight and have two rounds of IVF that you've paid for, and then actually I've managed to lose weight because I've gone on weight loss injections or I've had a bypass or whatever, you have lost your NHS rounds of IVF
because you've already
had it previously unsuccessfully.
So I always have these really intense conversations with people because I'm just like, if you're gonna have private funded, just that remember that you're then kind of committed to the private sector.
Even if you then fit the criteria. Because you don't fit the criteria.
Because that's an exclusion.
So it's a lot to think about for people with regards to funding. And I think it's just not known. And it's not even known when people get to write to the clinics where they're getting their results. So there can be a lot of awkward conversations with people. But yeah, we do try and encourage people, if it is to lose weight, we have got like a fit for fertility.
Information to give people.
Yeah, but it's easier said than done, isn't it?
Oh, definitely, like,
And I can sit there and be like, be healthier, but it's a really difficult conversation to have with people. So that's the first kind of thing with regards to funding. And then treatment wise, there are certain things that you don't need to qualify for that you can have, so further investigations and further treatments. So if for example, we want to check if your tubes are patent, there is an investigation that we do called a HiCOSI. So that is an investigation whereby, you know, we're talking about the transvaginal scanning. So you come in and we're looking to check that your tubes are working. So what we're going to do is pop that little speculum in to see your cervix, pop a little balloon into your womb, and then we inject kind of water to watch it coming out of your tube so we can see it on the scan. So to make sure that they're kind of open. So we would always have that if you're going to have ovulation induction, for example, which we'll discuss in a second. And you can have that whether you've got a child or not, and as long as you're in our hospital, as long as your BMI is less than 35. So that is another investigation that can be offered. Now, other people, when you get the results back, might need further treatments, whether they meet criteria or not. And it's not necessarily to even get pregnant, but it's kind of a, we found something that would need something doing about. So if you found a polyp or a fibroid or something that you think needs removing hysteroscopically, so that's a camera inside your womb, then people can be listed and have that procedure done. So we don't need to meet any kind of NHS criteria for that.
And you don't have to pay for investigations? At all? No matter what your criteria are?
Okay, that's good.
So all of that bit is kind of pre...
pre-decision.
I suppose the only thing is that kind of like... really bad circle, which we've discussed in previous episodes, whereby you go through all that, you get to the end, and then they're like, oh, your BMI is 34, and then we put you on a patient-initiated follow-up for 6 months, and actually you've not managed to get your BMI less than 30, but then a year and a half after that, you've got your BMI less than 30, and then you go through everything again. But there isn't a way of, like, you can't keep everybody in the books just in case.
No, I guess it's something that when you go to your GP... and they're going to refer you, and you might have a long wait to even get those tests. At that point, your GP, ideally, if you're not aware, should really be drilling in.
Yeah.
If you're going to get free IVF, you want your BMI to be under 30, so you do it now, because it's not easy.
You need time to be able to do that as well, don't you?
So the other thing, if you listen to this podcast,
do it.
Everyone
now.
Trying to keep BMIs under 30 forever.
So if in your tubes that we found that, you know, we talk about having water in your tubes, and then got a hydrosalpinx, so your tube looks like it's swollen.
Okay.
So we know that if you have swollen, like, water in your tubes, there is a 50% decreased rate of implantation if you have IVF.
Wow.
Okay.
50%.
So if we're talking about if you're, like, 30, 32, and I'm saying that there's, like, a 35% chance that you will get pregnant, 50% less.
Yeah.
So every transfer you have, it's like a 17% chance of getting pregnant.
It's not very
high.
Which
is pretty rubbish.
No. Yeah.
So we would also counsel about going in, having a laparoscopy, so a camera inside your tummy button, having a look, and if your tubes do look like they've had fluid in, and you're going to be someone that qualifies for NHS-funded IVF, or if you're going to have IVF, then you should remove that tube because it is...
It's
really
not working,
hampering your chances of getting pregnant rather than anything else.
Okay.
So that is one of the other things that we do offer for people, whether it's primary or secondary, whether their partner has a child or not. So that's one of the other things that we can do. With regards to endometriosis, I think there's a lot of chat about people not being able to get pregnant when they've got endometriosis.
Definitely.
Now, this is a really difficult one because we wouldn't go to look for endometriosis.
Just because
someone's struggling with fertility.
Yes, it wouldn't be kind of a, you're struggling with fertility, therefore let's go and have a look for endometriosis.
If they also had symptoms of endometriosis, you would consider looking?
We wouldn't particularly look because we would just get on with treatment.
Okay.
But if they had an endometrioma that was really big, so a big cyst, we were talking before about those chocolate cysts in their ovaries. So if they had a big cyst in their ovary.
Which you would see on an ultrasound scan.
We're linking this up now.
Yeah. And it was preventing you from being able to kind of collect the follicles, so these are in the ovary, then we would think about going in and draining these.
Yeah.
And that was to be to kind of improve the chances of IVF working, basically.
Okay.
So you don't want to destroy ovarian tissue, because if we're destroying ovarian tissue, then we're affecting that fertility potential.
Yeah.
Like, we want as many follicles as possible. If you've gone on to try and remove a cyst, then you could end up having to remove the ovary because if it bleeds a lot or you've kind of had to destroy more ovary than you wanted, then that's not a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you don't need the treatment, then we wouldn't go in and do the treatment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there was a little bit of data that said that if you have stage 1-2 endometriosis and we do treat that, then your chances of getting pregnant might increase slightly.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't recommend going to treat stage 1 and 2 endometriosis just to get pregnant, because the evidence isn't that good.
Okay.
And you might cause more harm by actually doing the surgery in the first place. Yeah.
And then with regards to other treatment of endometriosis, it should just be on a symptom basis.
Yeah.
So the only things it should be is to improve access.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got these big cysts and we can't get to your follicles,
to when you have your egg collection.
Yeah, improve access to your ovaries, decrease inflammation, decrease symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to kind of clear the pelvis of endometriosis.
Yeah.
You're kind of thinking about what is going to get you to the goal of pregnancy.
Yeah.
So I think it's quite difficult with regards to endometriosis. And also, I think, as we mentioned before, we've really got to think that most people with endometriosis will get pregnant and they won't need fertility treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to think about with regards to that. Mm-hmm. So that's endometriosis, surgery, what we potentially might do.
Yeah.
The other things for polycystic ovary syndrome. So if you meet criteria... and you have polycystic ovarian syndrome, but you've still got to meet the criteria. And then we could think about ovulation induction. So these are for people that have had your hyperplasia. We've checked that your tubes are patent. We know that the sperm is of good quality.
Mm-hmm.
There's no point giving somebody ovulation induction if the sperm's rubbish.
No, that's true.
So you've really got to remember that. You're like,
oh yeah, actually that's a pointless exercise, if the sperm wasn't going to get them pregnant, whether they're having ovulation or if they're ovulating or not, if it's a both sided thing, so PCOS is a problem, but actually also the sperm's a problem, genuinely no problem, no point doing ovulation induction. So you've got to like think everything through. But ovulation induction is something that can be offered to people that aren't ovulating. So this can make you have induce a cycle and induce for you to have an ovulation and for you to potentially get pregnant.
Hopefully not a period.
So if you've had your, you've been referred to infertility to fertility clinic, you've had your tests, sperm count, everything, semen analysis is normal, you have PCOS and you ovulate 4 times a year or less, you're not ovulating at all. You still have to meet NHS funding criteria to get ovulation induction medication. You can't just get that.
No.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I feel like we used to be a lot more liberal with these things, but it's not a thing
I feel
anymore.
Like people used to get that in gynae clinics sometimes, without having a semen analysis check.
No, I totally agree. But it's just not
it's
a thing
different
anymore.
Now. Okay, that's really good to know, actually, because I think a lot of people wouldn't know that either.
No. Yeah. When we give ovulation induction, we warn about that. It increases your chance of twins. There's a couple of different medications that we give, but if you're ovulating, it obviously completely changes your chance of getting pregnant. And we usually give a 6-month course, but we ask you to monitor your ovulation so that we know that it wasn't just 6 months in the air of pointless.
Chances are really good with ovulation induction. So if you have PCOS and then you have ovulation induction, 80% of people will get pregnant.
Okay. Because so it's really good. Well, because it's increasing it to normal.
Yeah, you've actually got that chance. Yeah.
Is it the same medication you use for ovulation induction as you would use for period induction?
No. No.
Okay.
Different.
That's, I thought it was.
But sometimes with ovulation induction, you need to have the period inducing medication. Because if you tell me that you don't have any periods, then when are you going to start the ovulation induction medication? Because you need to take it between days 2 and 6 of your period.
Yeah. So you have to, if you had none, you would have
you take the norethisterone, have a bleed, then start taking either the Clomid or Letrozole on day 2 of your period.
Okay.
Yeah. And then what you would hope is that because you've taken this medication to recruit a follicle, then you should ovulate at ish like the normal time, so day 13, 14, 15. And then you've actually got a chance of getting pregnant.
Yeah.
If you're not ovulating, you got no chance of getting pregnant. So ovulation induction can be one of the things that we use, but not on everybody. We have a lot of people that come through and say, oh no, I don't want to go for IVF, but I have heard about ovulation induction. You're like, but you have periods every month.
Yeah, if you ovulate
you
every
month,
you don't need
it. There's no point. Yeah. Like, it genuinely doesn't do anything. Like, if you're ovulating.
It's only for people that are not ovulating.
Yeah, yeah. So we've definitely had that conversation quite a lot to be like, it's not going to help.
Yeah.
And we need to think about something else.
Yeah.
So that is ovulation induction. And we've discussed about hydrocephalic pinks. And sometimes we look to make sure the tubes are patent. If you have a high COSI, so the investigation where we do the ultrasound and the tubes don't look like they're working, sometimes you need to have a laparoscopy and we check that the tubes are working because you could still have a blockage that we haven't been able to see.
Can you unblock if there's a blockage?
So sometimes by having a lap and dye, it will unblock the tubes, but it's not like a treatment per se, but sometimes people can find that that would unblock the tubes. But if you, for example, have an infection, you know, I said it was important that we check for chlamydia and gonorrhea, we don't want to be flushing infection into the abdomen.
That feels
can make you more unwell.
Yeah.
Very unwell.
The other thing is that males sometimes will need an operation. So we've said that sometimes we can't find sperms. So if we can't find sperm, then you would do another sample because sometimes
just double check.
They miss the pot or they like waited too long with it at home. Or
so much faith in these men.
How small are the pots?
We have loads that are like half in, half out of pot.
No.
If they've got no sperms and what we would do is check the hormone profile because I've said sometimes people just aren't producing the right hormones. And we would also check the genetics because we said about the chromosomes. And they can also have these micro deletions on some of the arms of the chromosomes, which can make you infertile, basically. I think that's all we need to say about that. But it does help us. So having all that information would give us a percentage of who would be benefiting from having an operation to try and get sperm out of the testicles.
Yeah.
Okay.
And to do that operation, you are asleep.
Yes.
So just to be clear,
you don't have to be awake and watch.
The man would be under general anaesthetic, and it would be a very simple, straightforward procedure where you just open the scrotum. This probably is making, if any man listen to this, which I hope they do, probably making them cringe. But yeah, you open the scrotum, and then you just take a biopsy from the testicle, really.
Yeah.
It's very, very quick, and then you get this lovely, like, jock strap supportive thing for a few days afterwards.
You get fitted for it to make sure it's precise.
But it is quite straightforward, and you would be asleep is the main thing during that
procedure. I feel like they would not do that awake.
No.
Men, that is. So tonight.
Yeah, no.
And we can tell them kind of the proportion of what we might find, because if you've got, like, a blockage, then there's practically 100% that we will get sperm from the testicle if it's just a blockage.
Yeah.
But if you have one of these micro deletions, then we can tell you that actually there's a 0% chance, so we won't do it, or there is a 30% chance, so it might work. So there's kind of all different levels, basically, of what it might work out as. And we do a teasy, but you can also have a micro teasy by a urologist that uses, like, those little, you know, the like the microscope things.
Oh,
you know, like the surgeons that, like, you know, vascular surgeons when they're operating and, like, tying vessels together, and they use, like,
funny glasses.
Well, they use suture that you kind of can't see to the naked eye, so they have to use, like, the magnifying glasses things. So this is what the urologists do to do microteses, so they can see the specific places.
Are they doing the same thing? Are they opening the scrotum?
Pretty much the same thing, but they would be looking to see.
They're looking for the sperm.
Well, not looking for the sperm per se. They're looking for areas that might look better and worse, whereas we're doing it a bit more a bit more macroscopically rather than microscopically.
Cool, I didn't know that.
Quite a question, which is a bit of a tangent, but you know how we've said that if you have a blockage in your fallopian tube as the woman, you could potentially get rid of that. If a man has a blockage in his tube, you can't do anything to flush that?
No.
Okay.
But you can get sperms easy and just use that as part of IVF.
Yeah. Fair play.
Because, as we said in a previous episode, when someone's had, for example, a vasectomy, so they've had the tubes tied, the chances of reversal, chances of it working out pretty slim.
Okay.
So,
but you can just have a simple teasy.
It's a great
fast
name.
Asleep teasy.
Yeah. And we discussed about hysteroscopy already. So... The big question everyone asks.
We really wanted to cover supplements, because we know that there are
so many.
Loads of them, and it's a really accessible thing for you to do if you're, you know, struggling with fertility, trying to get pregnant. Look online, look anywhere, there'll be supplements for that.
Accessible, but also is the correct information.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What is recommended and what isn't?
Yeah,
is there anything harmful?
Well, I think on the whole, people need to understand that you need to be on folic acid.
Yeah.
Like, so the, only the woman needs to be on folic acid.
But genuinely, like...
People might not know.
Yeah.
Would it do anything to
us? So men can take vitamins, and there are vitamins proven to increase sperm parameters.
Yeah.
So we ask them to go home and take them for 3 months. There's something called Impril is one of the ones that we usually recommend, because
lots
that's
of different
had,
brands, isn't there?
Yeah, that's had kind of
girls.
Yeah, that's had the evidence behind it.
Yeah.
We asked them to take those for 3 months, and then we would do a
retest
of the semen analysis. That's because I've said before, males are in that really fortunate position of they can actually make their sperms better.
They can almost
refresh it, can't they?
They
can have a restart, but
produced every 3 months. Yeah. So if you've had a really bad 3 months where you've smoked and done cocaine and had a hot tub every night, then, you know, in 3 months' time, if you change your behaviour, 3 months later, you'll have a whole fresh set of sperm that haven't been exposed to all of that. So it is actually really, it's important that men know that, and that they can make such a big difference.
Yeah.
So
they're very lucky they shouldn't just have hot tubs and do cocaine and smoke.
Don't think it's fine to stop it for three months.
No. Yeah. Your life, your choice.
But that's not medical advice.
Not medical advice.
Folic acid, definitely.
Yeah.
And if you're taking folic acid, or if you're taking any kind of preconceived pregnancy kind of vitamin, you've got everything you need. Really try not to worry about other things.
Yeah.
I think
that's
the main thing. And you want to be eating a healthy diet. So there's this whole thing about eating the rainbow. If you're trying to eat all of the different colours and not all the different...
And that's not
just Skittles.
Not the rainbow of junk food, as my child said the other day. Not helpful. Rainbows of like fruit, veg, that kind of thing. Then you're really just making yourself as healthy as possible. Vitamin D can improve reproductive health, but you're going to get your vitamin D from your pregnancy vitamin that we've just discussed about. Omega-3 you can take as separately or as part of a vitamin, your pregnancy vitamin. That can improve egg quality, but it's not going to give you a whole new batch of eggs. As we said, your eggs age. You can't do anything about your age. If we could reverse aging, that would be your best
would be chance. Sorry.
But we know that we can't do that. We've got an infographic that we've made, and what we're going to do is post that so people can have a look at the infographic, and that's got lots of information about supplements on that.
So we'll put that on our Instagram page.
I think people get really obsessed with coenzyme Q10, DHEA and testosterone. And I think if you've not had any problems with regards to coming through and having failed cycles of IVF and that kind of stuff, I think you need to put it to one side. Because there isn't the evidence behind these. People are just buying them online. They don't know what's in them. And with your coenzyme Q10, for example, you can get it in two different versions, and one of them your body can take and absorb, so ubiquinol, but the other one it can't. And you're just kind of a bit like, if you're not sure what you're getting, I really wouldn't get into this, and I would just take a pregnancy vitamin, and you're doing the best you can. And you're going to have way more luck by eating healthily and exercise and taking a pregnancy vitamin
rather than having your body under stress.
I think that's a nice message that, like, a lot of these supplements, if you have got the right source, are not going to do any harm. But if this is stressful for you, you don't know what you're taking, you're spending lots of money and you're not sure if it's actually worth it, then it's probably not worth it. It probably isn't giving you any benefit. And a lot of these things are things that, you know, even if you weren't trying to get pregnant, a lot of nutritionists would recommend you taking. So, like, have a healthy diet, etc. But then, like, having a multivitamin plus things like omega-3, plus potentially other things, what you mentioned, what was the other thing you mentioned? Yeah, and like DHEA and all of those things can be beneficial just for your general health. It also seems to apply to fertility, but there's not as much evidence that it will make a big difference. So don't panic, I guess. Don't worry about it too much if it's stressful.
Try not. I think anything that you're seeing that says, especially on DHA and testosterone front, when it says
DHEA,
it's like a male. So it's diet, I need to read the other thing, because it's dehydroepiandrosterone.
I'm so sorry I asked you to say that.
Well, it's a steroid hormone secreted from the ovarian theca cells.
Okay.
But we definitely just call it DHA, because that's much, much easier.
Got you.
But we have a lot of people that come to fertility clinic that have read something that they're like, if I take DHA for 3 months, then I'm going to just get my amazing eggs. But actually, there's been proper studies done on this, and you may even get an extra egg collected at IVF, during IVF, but it doesn't translate to live birth. I genuinely think that we're focusing on the wrong bit. And again, it's not, we can't prescribe it, so you have to buy it online. When you're buying something online, what on earth are you
getting?
I think the coenzyme Q10 thing really highlights that. You go on Amazon, you've heard that it's a good supplement, you see it there for a fiver, you take it for 3 months, but actually then you realise you've taken the wrong form, and it wouldn't have made any difference if there was a difference to be made. So you need to do a lot of research into it, really, to
definitely
be sure.
And always can ask your doctor as well.
And
they
definitely
can advise you on if they think it's something that's right or not.
I think the only one to actually mention is inositol, which we discussed in our PCOS episode. Because this has been proven to regulate periods, because it helps with your insulin resistance. So in people that have got PCOS and are not ovulating regularly, this can help. So it's not going to help people that are ovulating regularly, won't do anything with regards to that, but it can help with people that have got PCOS. So that is one supplement that you could think about taking if you've got PCOS. I think a lot of people with PCOS also discuss about metformin as well. Taking metformin doesn't translate to live birth rate, again, but it can help with insulin resistance, and it can help preventing ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. So sometimes in a clinic setting, we will put people on metformin and ask for them to get inositol, but it's to help the IVF setting rather than to treat PCOS.
So I feel like we've said IVF quite a lot. Do you want to ask Firstly, what does IVF stand for?
Yep.
And also, could you give us a bit of a run through of what happens when you come for IVF?
Yeah, let's do like a little walkthrough of what happens. So IVF, in vitro fertilisation. So as we said, we said that people get funded for different amounts of cycles of IVF on the NHS. And we always say IVF, which is just the way that you fertilise the egg, which means there's a dish and you have an egg in a dish, put a load of sperms with it, and one of the sperms hopefully will fertilise the egg. That's IVF, in vitro fertilisation. A lot of times, though, we use something called ICSI, whereby I clearly don't do this, so the embryologist will look at the sperm and pick the best sperm and inject the sperm straight into the egg that's been stripped of its outside.
Is outside of the body as well?
Yeah, all outside of the body. But all of this is funded in the same way. So if you are funded for two cycles of IVF, which is what we usually say, it could be two rounds of ICSI. It's just the way of fertilisation.
Could it be one of each?
Yeah. If IVF doesn't work, then you could have ICSI. So I think people get very stuck on, like, what is IVF and what is ICSI, and it's just literally the way of fertilisation.
IVF is sort of our umbrella term, I guess.
It is.
Because that's what people have heard of, right?
Yeah, kind of. The actual meaning is what Nick said, an egg in a dish being fertilised by sperm, but then it's become a broader term for the whole process.
Yes. I think so. It's like a broader term for, like, fertility treatment.
Yeah.
Because I think everybody always used to use ART.
So ART is assisted reproductive technologies.
Which that's kind of gone out of fashion,
But that is what it is. Yeah. So really, you've got your ART, and then within that, you can have IVF, ICSI, intrauterine insemination, ovulation.
But IVF's the one we've all chosen to go with.
But that's just more colloquial. That's what people know it to mean.
So you now know what IVF and ICSI are.
So ICSI stands for intracytoplasmic sperm injection.
Yes.
She's got it. That.
So if someone came in.
So what they would do is they would come in, they'd have that appointment where you've told them all the results, you've decided that actually the only way that we need to go is to have IVF / ICSI. Mm-hmm. You've written and asked if they can have funding. They've received a letter to say they've got funding. We've also received a letter to say they've got funding. Then they are booked into a clinic, an IVF clinic. In the IVF clinic, we go through the history and everything again, and we tell them about the process of IVF. Mm-hmm. So instead of doing that, I will just tell you about the process of
IVF.
Let's
do that,
So what happens is the female will have a scan at the beginning when they're on their period just to make sure that everything looks okay, so their ovaries are nice and quiet, so they've got no cysts or anything like that on their ovaries. We can see that their tubes are, well, we shouldn't be able to see their tubes, which is a good thing, and that their endometrium looks nice and thin because they're on the period. And then what will happen on day two is that they will start an injection in their tummy. That injection is to make all of these follicles get bigger.
Okay.
So on a monthly basis, you will recruit one follicle, and that one follicle, sometimes two, one follicle will get bigger, ovulate, and then there's a chance of pregnancy. Mm-hmm. When you have IVF, it's very different. We want like all of the follicles in your ovaries to get bigger so that we can collect all of the eggs, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we give you these injections in your tummy. You'll have that one injection once a day.
And you do it yourself at home?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to go in every day?
It's not every day back at the clinic.
No, imagine.
Nick's busy.
Imagine. And that is FSH, it's a follicle-stimulating hormone to produce lots of follicles in the ovary. You will have that for the first 6 to 7 days, and then what you will do is start a second injection, and that's to prevent you from ovulating. Because we want you to produce lots of follicles, but we don't want you to ovulate because we want to collect these eggs, okay?
Yeah.
So we don't want you to naturally have an LH surge because we want to be able to collect these eggs.
Yeah.
So you'll have these two injections now, one in the morning, one at night, and then you will come for a scan. Different clinics will be very different. We scan ish on day 9, 10 or 11. Doesn't really matter. And then at that scan, you will be ready for collection or you won't be ready for collection. Again, doesn't matter. Sometimes people need a little bit more stimulation. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people need a little bit less stimulation. What we do is have a look at what both of your ovaries are doing, if you've got two ovaries, and how many follicles they're in and how big they are. Because we want them to be of a certain size for us to collect the eggs from them. Now, anything over 10 to 12 millimetres should have a mature egg in it, but we want
them really to be more like 16, 17, 18 millimetres. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. So if you've got 10 in each side and they're all 16, 17 millimetres, your ovaries are big. And that's why when people are like, oh, when they scanned me, my ovary was only able to be seen on my tummy and it was right up here. If you think they've got heavier and heavier and heavier because they've got these follicles in and they've like dropped into kind of a good place for us to be able to get to, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we've got all these follicles in, hopefully we have recruited well, we've given you the right medication, and we're just going through, like, the barn door of, you know, this is a one-size-fits-most, it's definitely not a one-size-fits-all.
Changes.
Yeah, there are some people that we won't recruit and they'll have an abandoned cycle, there are some people that have shot off too early will abandon the cycle. There's lots of different semantics with this, but what will happen is you'll be hopefully ready on your scan, and then what we'll do is stop both of those medications and plan for your extraction, so your collection. So what happens is we give you a different medication, and then 36 hours after that we collect. So, for example, if you had your trigger injection on a Monday night at 9 p.m. you would be collected on a Wednesday morning at 9 a.m.
Okay.
So on the day of collection, you give yourself your trigger injection and all that kind of stuff. So sometimes people have got to give them really late at night because obviously...
It's got to be well-timed for...
It's got to be the right time. And you have one of two injections for your trigger. One of them, if we're going to collect and we're potentially going to put an embryo back. One of them if we're going to collect and we're just going to freeze anything. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes if people have produced a lot of follicles or if sometimes people aren't expecting to have an embryo transfer, then we will give them an injection, which means that we stop their chances of getting ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. By giving you the HCG trigger, that would increase your chance of getting ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. Ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome basically means that you've got fluid in the wrong place. So we've made lots and lots of follicles in your ovaries. Then we've collected from each follicle, so we've punctured them, and there's loads and loads of HCG, and you've basically pulled fluid into your tummy. So you might be dry, as in dehydrated, but you might have a massive tummy full of water.
Oh.
Worst case scenario, well, there is very worst kind of scenario, but some people would need that fluid draining, but sometimes it can even go into your lungs and can make your breathing really bad as well.
There's different stages, isn't there? So with OHSS, it's most of the time a bit of a mild stage where you might feel a bit uncomfortable, your tummy might feel a bit tense, you might feel a bit sick, but as long as you've got signs that you're hydrated enough, like your blood pressure's okay, your heart rate's okay, you're passing urine, your blood tests are all right, you can usually just stay at home. But a small number of people will have a severe form, which is when they would be like very, very dehydrated, and that can put you at risk of problems. And they would usually need to come into hospital and be monitored, potentially have the fluid drain, but not always. And you mentioned HCG trigger. That's the trigger that helps you, that makes you ovulate. So that's the one that you take 36 hours before your egg collection.
You can have HCG or Bucerolin. There's different makes of them all, though. But one of them...
It's a trigger injection.
Yeah, it's a trigger injection. Isn't it? So it's the final maturation of the eggs, basically.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make you ovulate, it just makes the final maturation. So that they're ready for us to collect them, basically. When you come for a collection, different clinics do it differently. Sometimes you'll have sedation, sometimes you won't. Most clinics, I think, do offer sedation. So you would come in on that morning fasted, so nothing to eat or drink. You would go through at your appropriate time, because we know that obviously 9 p.m, 9 a.m. Come through, and what we would do is with the transvaginal scan, it would have a needle on top of it. So we would go from the back of your vagina into the ovary and puncture each of the follicles and collect the fluid from each of the follicles. This is with you asleep. Like sedated, so the anaesthetist is there. But you get totally live feedback. So when I'm collecting them, they're going into a little container. The nurse takes the container through to the embryologist, and the embryologist is like, right, first egg, second egg, third egg.
So it's very real time.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you're not getting eggs when you think you should be getting eggs, you would stop. If they've had a HCG trigger, you can do a pregnancy test to make sure that they've taken the test the injection correctly. Because if the pregnancy test is negative and they've had a HCG trigger, then they've not taken the trigger correctly.
Okay.
So there's different like little
points that we can get to if we're not getting eggs, but on the whole, you get live feedback with the eggs, great. Which is pretty cool. Wow. Mm-hmm.
How many eggs would you usually collect?
Oh, it's just totally different on, yeah, everybody. Really, really depends. So we give a bucerellin trigger and we collect and freeze anybody that's expected to get over kind of 17, 18 eggs.
That's because they're at a higher risk of OHSS, the more follicles you have.
So even if we give them the trigger that you could give a fresh transfer to, if you get over 20 eggs collected, or if there's lots of free fluid, so lots of fluid already when we're doing the collection, we would advise for a freeze-all cycle.
So not a fresh transfer means that you've got the egg, you've fertilised it, you don't freeze it, you put it back in.
Yeah.
Not on the same day.
No.
I was going to say.
We'll carry on. And then a frozen cycle means that all of the eggs are fertilised and frozen as embryos.
And that's because OHSS.
Yeah, so we get
carriers.
Well, it gets worse if you get pregnant.
Ah, okay. That makes sense then.
So it's just a preventative thing.
So basically the HCG that's produced by the pregnancy makes the OHSS worse. Oh. So you get like a secondary OHSS, which we are even less able to help because you're now pregnant.
Yeah.
So you can look very pregnant before you're even hardly
that pregnant. Yeah. Yikes.
So you go home that day after your collection. They either inject or mix the sperm with the egg. And then the next day, the embryologist will ring and they'll say, right, you had 10 eggs collected and 7 of them are fertilised. We'll give you an update on day 3. Okay. So there's a drop-off at every stage. And I think also this is what people find hard to understand. So if you have 10 eggs collected, you might have 7 that will fertilise, and you might have 2 or 3 that get to day 5. Mm-hmm. One of them you will have put back if you're having a fresh transfer, and 30% of people will get something frozen.
Okay.
So it's a numbers game. Mm-hmm. Like a numbers play game that we don't play very well most of the time because there is just such a big drop-off at every stage. And I think it's really difficult for people to understand because they're like, well, they're 10 eggs collected. Like, how have I only got 1 to put back and nothing to freeze? And it's just, it's rubbish. Like, that's what happens. So when we were talking about that AMH at the beginning, your anti-Müllerian hormone and your fertility potential, and if you only had 4 follicles in your ovary right at the beginning, so we're only, if we recruit those 4 and manage to get them all to get bigger and we collect eggs from 4... play that numbers game.
Yeah.
It's not good. So it's that kind of trying to like set expectations. And yes, at the end of the day, you only need 1, but you need 1 to at least get in and get implanted.
I swear one of the Kardashians had this and I saw it on the show. I swear. Don't know which one.
Probably.
All it's made me think of, sorry.
Katie Price had it, didn't she, on a recent, I think there's
been. Oh, yeah. I think so.
It didn't work. But I think she's done a recent series on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think she has got
Sorry, went into celebs there.
So you would be wrong on day 3 and kind of said, oh, we've got how many, this is what's developing. And most people would have a day 5 transfer rather than day 3 transfer. Mm-hmm. And then you would come back on the day of transfer and come in again, but you're not put to sleep. You would have that speculum inserted and we would pop the embryo into the womb. So it's there, ready. And then 11 days later, you do your pregnancy test.
Fingers crossed.
Keep everything crossed.
And so, the average success rate pregnancy test was?
Depends on your age.
Yeah.
But overall in the UK, it's a 28% live birth rate.
Okay, so that's a baby at the end.
Yes.
Fine.
So pregnancy test will be more than that because you will have people that will have a positive pregnancy test and unfortunately have a miscarriage or have an ectopic pregnancy.
Right.
But the overall live birth rate is about
28%. And is that per embryo transfer?
Yeah, per embryo transfer.
Okay.
And you've got higher chance of pregnancy if you're younger. Mm-hmm. So if you're 30, you've probably got a 40% chance of pregnancy.
Yeah.
But if you're 40, 41, then you might have kind of a 5 or 6% chance of pregnancy, depending on the quality and what is collected and what happens.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff to think about.
Yeah. No, it's good. But I think it's good to hear the run by step-by-step thing, how it actually runs most of the time.
Yes. Yeah, I think we should go into other tests and other things that you can have done on another episode.
It's just a huge topic, isn't it?
There's so much to go into.
I think this is kind of like the, you know, what the causes of infertility, the tests you'll have, and the kind of standard IVF.
Yeah.
But then we'll do a more special episode on different tests that are available to some people, but might not be for everyone.
Yep.
And then obviously we'll talk about same-sex couples and single people as well, and surrogacy and all of those kind of things.
Yeah, all very important. So
keep your eye out for that.
And definitely.
I think really interesting.
Okay. So let's do, have we got any myths/questions?
Yeah. So the first one is one that I saw on TikTok.
Shock.
You know when you see something, you're just like, am I stupid or is this totally fake? So I do want a genuine answer. There was this doctor
saying, she wanted an answer.
There was this doctor saying that if you eat all your food and drinks cold, that will mess with your fertility.
I think she's lost
the plot. You're not stupid.
You're not stupid.
You know when you're like, oh, I had a hot meal for my dinner last night.
No, and what was the rationale? What was the explanation? Did she say why?
If you eat things cold and you drink cold things, it's just going to make you
infertile. As if, like, your fertility is that fragile. Like, if you if you're struggling with infertility, it's not going to be because you had a cold lunch.
Yeah.
Like, there's going to be a
someone
more
commented on it and said, is this for men and women or just women?
Yeah.
She was like, no, men as well. You should all be eating food warm.
Yeah.
Honestly?
And she was literally,
she like got some sort of shares in a microwave company, some like cooker company.
She was slagging off salads and things, and I was like,
how strange.
But we do want people to eat healthily. That's the focus.
I'm
here.
Not a fan of salads, but also,
but if you are, it's not going to stop you getting pregnant.
No, definitely not. Yeah, that was my crazy myth.
Definitely.
Yeah, and then we've got a few also random like nutrition-y bits. Ooh. That drinking a water, fenugreek seed, sesame seed and ginger shot will cure infertility.
Yeah, so nothing will cure infertility. Mm. And you're better going down the normal routes and having things checked.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big believer in that if you like something and you're wholeheartedly behind it, so for something like acupuncture or for something like meditation and that kind of thing, if it makes your headspace better, do it.
Yeah.
If it's going to put you into massive debt and you're stressed when you're there because you're thinking about how much it costs and also because the bed's creaking and something else happened, that kind of stuff, then just don't have it.
Yeah.
I think it's very, you need to just take a breath and be like, is this benefiting me or not?
Yeah.
And if it's not, don't have it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good advice.
The next one that was really common and feels a little bit annoying if you were going through it was people are saying, you know, just relax and you won't be infertile.
Just relax.
Just breathe.
But also, yeah, and we talked about this, I think, in the How to Get Pregnant episode.
Yeah.
There is evidence that being like having a high level of stress can impact on your fertility, but that doesn't mean that if you just relaxed, you would then get pregnant.
Yeah. And also, just relax. How'd you do that?
Exactly.
And it's like, tell someone to relax. That makes it's
you feel
even
more
harder
stressed.
To relax.
Yeah.
I'm relaxed.
If you're trying to get pregnant and then someone tells you that being stressed is stopping you getting pregnant, that's just going to make you more stressed.
Yeah.
Like, of course, I'll just stop.
Sorry,
being stressed.
How can I be so silly?
But there's also lots of like interesting evidence that at times where people were extremely stressed, the birth rate hasn't decreased. During World War II, people were definitely stressed.
Oh, yeah.
And the birth rate didn't decrease.
Yeah.
So there is reassuring things out there as well. But obviously, if you can try and be less stressed, that's just better for your health in general.
Yeah.
If you can't, don't blame yourself.
No.
And we know that if people are very stressed, then it can affect their periods. So if your periods are affected, then ovulation is affected, then potentially
then
you're not going to get pregnant.
Yeah. Then it
but
will affect.
But I do think that
it's not a cure to infertility.
No.
Though.
Just
a yoga retreat will not cure your infertility.
No.
If you find that relaxing.
Yes.
The next myth was you can get pregnant at any age if you live a healthy enough lifestyle.
Yeah, no, sorry.
Because once you've hit menopause, well, or gone past
it's not
menopause,
even just
sorry.
That. When you so after the age of 37, your fertility really declines, and then after the age of 40, it really takes a bit of a nosedive, to be honest. And that's kind of
it's just genuinely
what happens,
yeah.
And that's because a lot of the eggs that you release won't have the right number of chromosomes.
Yeah.
So if you are to get pregnant, you have a much higher chance of miscarriage as well. So you do have people that sporadically will get pregnant later, like at 45, but it's really uncommon for that to happen, like genuinely really uncommon. And we, from an IVF setting, it just doesn't work. When you're 44, 45 with your own eggs, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll talk about donor eggs again in that next episode.
Another myth that we saw was that if you've had one child naturally, you'll be fine. You won't need IVF. You can't become, you know, someone who needs that.
No guarantees. So it's, you know, if you've had one child, hopefully that means you can get pregnant again. Yeah. But there are lots of things that can change.
Yeah.
Your lifestyle, medical problems, your partner. There's lots of things that can change.
You could have had a cesarean section. And when you have a cesarean section, sometimes you can have this niche where it keeps fluid in, which is like toxic to a pregnancy.
Oh God, yeah.
People can have preterm labours when they've had fully dilated cesarean sections. People can get blocked tubes if they've had an infection after they've delivered. There's lots of things that can change. But if you've had a child and you're somebody that's had a pregnancy, you are at a good chance of being able to have another pregnancy. Obviously, we've not mentioned, but they might have changed partner, and that if they've changed partner in that time, that can really change
the chance.
Yeah, we've got some questions as well from our followers. Yep. So someone's asked, are there any warning signs that I might be infertile before I start trying to get pregnant?
That's a good question. I guess, like, you know, you need to be having all the things that you need to get pregnant. So you need to be having periods.
You need to be ovulating.
And your partner needs to be able to ejaculate. If those two things aren't happening, then you probably do have a problem somewhere and something needs to be.
Yeah, and also, just slightly ad hoc, but if your mum's told you that she went through the menopause when she was 30, then that could be a bit of a factor in your life. So there are certain conditions that can make you more likely to go through the menopause early, and one of them can be hereditary. So those kind of things could make you slightly more concerned. But there isn't anything else that I would think you definitely need to be on this.
And then we've been asked, is there always a cure? And I wonder if that means, like, is there always a treatment that's gonna...
And I, do you know what? I think this is a really difficult one because, do you know what? No. And I think a lot of times when people get to the fertility clinic, they're like, at last.
I'm here.
We have waited
for
years. We're just going to have a baby now. And actually, a high proportion of people will never have a baby when they come through an IVF unit. And that's because of that numbers game. And if people had, there's some research that says, like, if everybody had 11 cycles of IVF, pretty much everybody would be pregnant. But who can afford,
who can do that,
who has the mental resilience, who
has the time, still a chance because that you're not going to
How old are you going to be? Because if you started at 39, you can't fit in 11 cycles of like I think it's really sad, but and I think that expectation setting when people come in, and I always do that kind of the numbers game of this is what's going to happen, just so that people are a bit more aware.
Yeah, I think that's the main, like, knowing what the chances are and being aware that it might not result in a baby. And then thinking about what that means for you. Does that mean that you'll be childless and that's okay? Does that mean that you'll go through adoption? Does that mean that you'll do something, you'll win the lottery and then have 11 cycles? Like, as long as I think you've thought about that at the beginning, not that it makes it easy, but it makes it easier to manage what happens at the end.
And also someone's asked, does applying a topical natural progesterone to the skin help at all?
So this is a difficult one because you can buy progesterone on the interweb.
If you're struggling with fertility,
I assume so.
But the problem is that you should only take progesterone in the second part of your cycle.
Okay.
And you don't know what you're buying off the internet.
I see this going wrong in a lot of ways.
If you have a short luteal phase, which we've discussed before in our fertility...
So the phase after ovulation, before your period.
So if that is very shortened, and that can be for various different reasons, people think that they should take progesterone. And there could be some evidence in taking progesterone, but taking a cream that you've bought off the internet that we don't know what's in it... is one whole bag of issues. And the other one is, if you take progesterone in the wrong part of your cycle, then you could be completely hindering your chance of getting pregnant.
Okay, good answer.
So, I think you need to be careful with that kind of stuff.
And then probably one of the most asked questions that might be quite a nice one to end on is, someone asked, have I done something to cause this? You know, is it their fault?
I think that's a really natural reaction. It's the same, like, with a miscarriage episode. First thing you think is, like, what have I done? What did I do? Even if you know really that you didn't. But no, like, overall, it's something that's happened to you. It's not something that you've brought on yourself or caused. It's really difficult. but it doesn't, looking back and thinking that you've done something wrong and blaming yourself for it will not help you.
And or looking back and thinking, oh, if only I'd have come through 5 years ago, but you didn't.
Yeah.
And, it wasn't the right time and you weren't with the right partner. Mm-hmm. And you, I think there's so many things. Like when I do an embryo transfer, basically people always say, so that's putting the embryo in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. People always say, what should I do now? Before my pregnancy test, what should I do? And I'm like, treat yourself as pregnant. If you think, should I or shouldn't I, then err on shouldn't. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, don't look back and think, oh, if only I'd not done that. Because there's always going to be if onlys. And you want to make that if only list as small as possible because mm-hmm. none of the if onlys are going to make a difference. Mm-hmm. But it's just, you just don't want your head to be in that space.
That's how you're going to feel afterwards. Yeah.
So if you're thinking, oh, I'd like to go on a 5K run, but, oh, that might affect it, just don't go on the 5K run.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's that kind of,
everyone's
like...
Everyone's individual, aren't they? If something's going to worry you, then maybe...
Just don't
try and avoid
think
it.
Think it through.
But on the whole, no.
Yeah.
No.
Good.
Fab?
Yeah.
Good.
I think that's everything.
Yeah.
Lovely. Well, we would like to put out a quick disclaimer to say that everything we've discussed here is not affiliated with where we work. Mm-hmm. They are our own medical opinions and they shouldn't be taken as direct medical advice.
Yeah. So please make sure you're following us and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And follow us on all of our socials at Between Two Ovaries.